Hello, welcome to this week's podcast, this episode. I am so excited and thrilled to be able to give you this guest. I am your host today, Sharon Pearson, and we're going to be joined today by a man who has been dubbed the world's most influential living philosopher. He has done phenomenal work influencing public morality, both with respect to the treatment of animals and in the growing movement known as effective altruism. You may know who I'm speaking about by now. This is a man who's been credited with being the father of the animal rights movement through his books and through co-founding what is today known as Animals Australia. This is Australia's largest and most effective animal welfare organization. He's also the professor of bioethics at Princeton University. He's also the founder and the board chair of The Life You Can Save. There will be links for all of this in the show notes if you'd like to check it out. I highly recommend it. You probably have one or two of his books on your shelves. He has written and co-authored, edited or co-edited more than 50 books through his phenomenal career, including Animal Liberation, which is this one here, The Life You Can Save, which is now available. If you go to the show notes, we'll have a link so you can get that book for free, including the Audible if you'd prefer. Practical Ethics, which is what I studied at university last year, The Expanding Circle, Rethinking Life and Death, One World, The Ethics of What We Eat, and The Point of View of the Universe. His writings appear in more than 25 languages. His books, Practical Ethics and Animal Liberation, are used extensively throughout the world in ethics classes, and his ideas appear regularly in seminars and conferences, as does he. He's a major contributor to how we think in this world today. This is because he appears so regularly because, according to Saka Akhtar from the magazine Believer, he approaches such topics with such a zeal that he suggests computing the moral significance of every passing minute. I just love that quote. He tackles the hard questions of the day, from research on cloned embryos to the use of animals in food and research. He argues that we must do much, much more than we do, donating differently, thinking differently about how we contribute to making this world a better place through his thinking of utilitarianism, which is a form of philosophy he will introduce you to. We cover in this conversation wide-ranging topics that mean so much to him, from animal liberation to various topics in his books, The Ethics in the Real World, where he has hundreds of ideas about how we can think about the world, morality, and practical ethics. We speak about an organization he's helped establish and how we can make a difference by becoming effective altruists. And at the end, he gives a personal plug to a new book that he's just edited that was written in the second century. I present to you Professor Peter Singer. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Sharon. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. So I'd like to get started. I am really curious to know what you're currently thinking about and working on.
Right now, I'm working on a revised edition of Animal Liberation.
Okay.
That's a book that I first published in 1975. It's never been out of print. But the most recent edition really is from 1990. By that I mean there are editions which look like they're more recent. There's a 2009 one, I think. Exactly, that's one of the paperbacks. It does have a new preface, and it has some additional material at the end, but the basic text in between the preface and the supplementary material at the end is pretty much unchanged for 30 years. So that's not good, obviously. If you want to keep up with what's going on in terms of factory farming, kinds of experiments that are performed on animals, and of course the impact of climate change and what that's done to our thinking about eating meat, we really, you know, I really need to make some changes, a lot of changes to the book. So that's my current project.
Well, I wasn't going to start there, but we will. And we'll talk about Animal Liberation and your book. You released it in 1975, and the landscape of animal liberation or animal welfare was very different then. Can you paint a scene of what it was like and what was the impetus for writing this, what ended up being a completely transformational book for animal welfare around the world?
Well, perhaps one way of getting people listening today to see how much the scene has changed is to say that my interest in animals and my thinking about the ethics of what I was eating got started just a few years before that, in 1970 to be precise, when I happened to have a conversation with a fellow graduate student. So I was 24 years old. I'd been to university in Melbourne, and then I'd gone to Oxford to do my graduate work. And I happened to meet a fellow Canadian who, when we went in for lunch, asked if there was meat in the sauce on top of the spaghetti. And when he was told there was, he took a salad plate instead. And so after we'd finished our conversation we were having, I asked him what his problem with meat was. And, you know, I think this was really the first conversation I'd had with a vegetarian. Maybe he was the first vegetarian that I'd met, or perhaps I'd met some Indian vegetarians for, you know, Hindu reasons, but certainly the first person who I'd met, a vegetarian, who just had a straightforward kind of ethical answer to that question, that he didn't like the way we treat animals and didn't really want to be complicit in the way animals were being treated. And so, you know, anybody who listening today or has been to university, you know, can hardly get their head around the fact that you can be 24 years old and not have met a vegetarian, and not really have thought about that. But that's how it was. That's pretty much how it was in 1975 when the book came out. And, you know, people did find it very strange to see a sort of serious argument about why we shouldn't be eating meat based on concern for the animals. Because, you know, if people thought about animal welfare at all, they thought about dogs and cats, maybe about horses, but they didn't really think about chickens and pigs and cows.
Part of what you describe when you talk about that book and why it came about, which I really loved, was it was a very sentimental attitude in the movement at the time. And the way you felt that you could contribute to the movement was with, you didn't say clearer thinking, with rationality. Can you speak a little bit to that? For those rare individual listening to this podcast who doesn't know who you are or the work that you've contributed to our planet and to our thinking, what was the thinking back then that led you to believe this is where I can contribute? And maybe this will be a way to start introducing consequentialism and utilitarianism and some of your other philosophical bedrock.
Right. So in terms of, you know, how I can contribute, it was sort of somewhat accidental that I ended up doing philosophy. Mm-hmm. I had gone to university planning to study law, and then an advisor thought I might find the law course a bit dry, and why didn't I combine it with an arts course? So I started doing combined arts law course. Then I got to enjoy the arts side of it more, and I got offered a scholarship to go on with graduate work in that field. And I went into philosophy. I enjoyed it. I found it interesting. But, you know, was it going to make a significant contribution to the world? I wasn't, you know, I couldn't say that that was my primary motivation at that time. But this was the late 60s and then early 70s. And of course, there are a lot of radical ideas around and radical political movements, including opposition to the war in Vietnam, which I was part of in Australia. And then there was the civil rights movement, the Black Liberation Movement. And so there were ethical ideas floating around, and it was always more the ethics and political philosophy side of philosophy that I was interested in. That was where, you know, where it makes a difference, I guess, where it has an impact on the way we live directly. So that's why when I started thinking about this issue of animals, and then, as you correctly say, at that time, there wasn't a real animal movement, or insofar as there were anti-cruelty organizations, they were mostly appealing to people's sentiments. So there would be cute pictures of puppies and kittens and asking you to, you know, help rescue them, something of that sort. But there was nothing really saying that even if you don't love animals, there are still something seriously wrong about the way we're treating animals. And I never did think of myself as an animal lover, and I still don't. But I do think that there are things very seriously wrong about the way we treat animals, and on a vast scale. So this is not a small issue, right? When you take account of the fact that there's over 70 billion animals raised and killed for food each year, the great majority of them indoors in factory farms, it's a very major issue.
One of the things I like about sentimentality when it comes to animal welfare is it can get the conversation started. So you have a very rational, and I'd love you to speak more about utilitarianism aspect to it, which I really admire. But I didn't get to my 18 years ago, I became a vegetarian and a vegan for a while. I didn't get there because of the reasons you've given, that it's the right thing to do and that it reduces the most suffering or increases the most pleasure. I got there because my health suffered and I went on an elimination diet and I needed to find recipes for a vegan. And there were barely any 20 years ago. And in reading recipes, I read about animal welfare. So the way I got there was very indirect. So what role do you think can be played in sentimentality or in other roads that get us to the conclusions you've come to?
Well, of course, a lot of people do get to these conclusions through love for animals in one way or another. You know, one of the greatest campaigners in the late 20th century for animals was a man I got to know called Henry Spira. And he was a great social activist working for Blacks in the American South and for underprivileged people everywhere. But he only started to see animals as underprivileged when a friend who was going overseas dumped a cat on him, and he'd never really thought about animals, but basically the cat seduced him. and you know, more or less around that time, he came across some of my writing, and that did help. But you know, yeah, without the cat, maybe we would have lost one of those great campaigners. Yeah. So I, you know, I'm not putting down love for animals at all. I think it's a great way to get people to understand that animals are individual beings, that their lives can go well or badly for them, and that we should be caring about them. We shouldn't just draw the boundaries of our moral concern around our own species. So, yeah, it definitely plays a good role. But, you know, you asked about my utilitarianism. So philosophically, I hold the view that the right thing to do is the action that will have the best consequences. And by best consequences, I and the classical utilitarians mean do the most to promote happiness and to reduce suffering. So from that, it straightforwardly follows that given that animals can suffer, at least many animals can suffer, we ought to be including them within our concerns of what we do. And we shouldn't just say, well, morality is only for humans. You know, there are some people who say, and probably more people who think that. But you know, we certainly think when it comes to humans that even if you're not particularly rational or you know, nevertheless you can't. We think humans have a certain moral status that makes it wrong to do things to them, even if they lose or never have the higher cognitive abilities. But but when it comes to animals, we say, well, they don't think, they're not self-conscious, they're not autonomous, they're not moral agents, all of these things. So they don't really count. But I think that's just a mistake. And it's, as I say, not something we consistently apply within our own species. So we shouldn't use it as a way of drawing lines between our species and other species.
You speak really eloquently about speciesism, and particularly around chimpanzees. I remember back in 2014, there was an article you wrote in this book that you've written, which I love, The Ethics in the Real World. And you're speaking about the rights of a chimpanzee. And in 2014, I understand it went to court in Europe to get a chimpanzee to have human rights. Talk about how the logic of utilitarianism arrives at that point where we elevate, that's really poor choice of words, to the same level as how we prize human life.
Yeah, well, as I say, I think it is a critique of drawing the boundaries of rights just around our species. And it's it's saying there are other things that matter. Now this particular case you mentioned was based on a chimpanzee, and chimpanzees do have you know, capacities to think and to reason to a certain extent and solve puzzles. And there's research showing that they anticipate things in the future. They're thinking ahead as well. Not to the same extent that we do, but significantly. So I think the chimpanzee was really taken as a kind of test case, basically challenging the courts to say, well, how is it that we're saying all human beings have rights, irrespective of their mental capacities, but he is an animal whose mental capacities are clearly superior to that of newborn babies and superior to that of some profoundly intellectually disabled humans, and yet this chimpanzee doesn't have rights. Why should that be? So I think that's basically a way to try to bridge the gulf that both law and popular morality place between humans and animals. And I think the thinking is that if you can do that for chimpanzees, well, we'll also bring some of the other animals closer. And although that 2014 case in Europe didn't succeed, there are other cases going on. And right now, the New York State Court of Appeal, which is pretty high, Kate, the highest court in the New York State system, is going to hear a case on behalf of an elephant who's been very miserably imprisoned solitary for many years in a zoo in New York. So that will be interesting. And it just the fact that the court has agreed to hear this case is something of a breakthrough. I think it's the highest level court in the English-speaking world anyway to hear a writ of habeas corpus, which is an ancient legal writ for, you know, basically it says, give me the body, you know, show me if the king was holding someone, you know, why can't you give that person over to me? Why are you holding him? And if the court says it does apply to an animal, that would be something of a breakthrough.
How do you think the animal liberation movement is doing since 1975? It's obviously come a long way. There's a lot more vegans. It's a more normal conversation to sit down in a restaurant and say, I'm vegetarian. I remember when I began being a vegetarian 20 years ago, it stopped conversations and restaurants had nothing. I remember traveling Italy and couldn't find anything but rice to have. It was so strange all those years ago. That's really basic and anecdotal. How far do you think the movement's come?
Well, it has come a long way in that respect, in the understanding of people choosing not to eat meat or even to be vegan, and what that means. You know, people wouldn't have understood what the word vegan meant 40 or even 20 years ago. So it's come a long way there. It's come a long way in terms of having some political influence and being recognized by governments as a group that they ought to listen to, that people do care about. But it hasn't come that far in terms of changing the conditions, which got me to think that what we're doing to animals is wrong, and wrong on a vast scale, because there are still billions of animals in factory farms. The conditions might have improved a little bit, might have been tweaked a little bit with some regulations in some countries, particularly the European Union has banned some practices that unfortunately still exist in Australia and still exist in much of the United States, although there are now 7 states, including California, that don't allow hens to be kept in cages, for example. So we're making progress, but it's been a long time. You know, you couldn't say it was rapid progress, unfortunately. Right. And I'd like us to move forward a lot faster.
If I was queen for a day, I would declare that all abattoirs had to be renamed slaughterhouses and had to have glass walls.
Well, exactly. In fact, though, we could just do it with webcams now. We really have the technology. We don't need glass walls. Yeah. And why not factory farms as well? You know, why not everywhere where animals are housed? Why not laboratories? Why doesn't the public have a right to see what's going on in these places?
Yeah. Our morality seems to move with proximity. Our morality meter goes up if we're proximate to the suffering. We have a view on that suffering. But the suffering that's out of sight, we're okay not having a view of, but it is the same suffering that is contributing to our choice of what we can eat or whatever. We need to close the proximity gap and suddenly your ethics will be normal.
Yes, I hope so. I hope we can do that. But you're right. We like to look away from things that are unpleasant and we just continue supporting them indirectly, because essentially buying the products of the animal exploitation industry is all the support it needs from us. And we continue to do that. But if somebody says, you know, do you know what life is like for an animal in a factory farm? A lot of people would just say, no, don't tell me. I don't want to know. You'll spoil my enjoyment of my next chicken or pig or whatever it might be.
Mm. Thank you, Peter. And can I also just, on behalf of my team here, who just love that you're here, thank you for the movement you created and how far you have fought for a cause that matters so much. This is going to go to 300,000-400,000 people. And I'm sure I speak for a lot of them saying you're extraordinary in your philosophy and the views you've put forward in the face of controversy, and you still just hold the line. I think it's extraordinary.
Well, thanks very much. I don't see that controversy is a reason for changing your views. Good arguments might be, but not controversy. But thank you. And I certainly appreciate the opportunity to communicate with your 300,000 viewers.
Yeah. I think it'll probably be more with Peter Singer. Yeah. I think that's the bottom baseline. We got into animal liberation because that's the work you're working on now. But what I've been thinking about, if I was to talk to Peter Singer, the question I want to ask him, which I puzzle over, is how do you determine what's right or wrong or good or bad? And I struggle even with utilitarianism. And perhaps we can speak about it through that frame, or you can bring something else in. But how do you think about what's good or bad or right or wrong?
Well, I do think about it through the frame of utilitarianism. That's something that I came to, obviously, over a period of time. And I think about it very often, and you know, you're certainly not the only one who doesn't find that easy to accept. And there are other very good philosophers who take different views. And of course, I listen to them and take a look at why they hold the views they do and why they don't accept utilitarianism. And that's an ongoing debate, and it should be. That's what philosophy is like. We don't try and enforce conformity or agreement. We encourage open debate, because that's the way in which we better understand our own positions and the positions of others. But for me, you know, some of the ideas like rights or duties, I want to know where they come from, and I don't get good answers. And in fact, when you ask people, well, what rights do people have, or what do you do when rights clash, I don't get very clear answers on that. It's not that I'm opposed to talking about rights, whether it's human rights or animal rights, but I think they have to be derived from something. And when I ask myself, what can they be derived from? It does seem to me that the only possible answer is better lives for all of those beings whose lives can go well or badly from their own internal perspective. And that really means beings who are conscious, beings who can feel something and feel pain or pleasure, have a good day or a bad day, or a good life or a bad life. So I think that's how we should be thinking about things. And we should be thinking about things not just for ourselves or our country or even for our species, but for all sentient beings, and not just for those who are there here and now, but also for those who will exist in future, as far as we can predict the future. And of course, to go back to what you were saying a few moments ago, not just for those who are in close proximity to us, but also those on the other side of the world who might be complete strangers. So that's the kind of framework that I use. It's one that's impartial between sentient beings, just giving equal consideration to their interests, whatever those, where the interests are comparable or similar, and trying to do what you can to make the world a better place in those terms.
Okay, so I guess the reason for my question is I'm noticing there's a lot more advocacy these days for hurt feelings being worthy of stopping a message. And then I listened to what you said about good and bad in another interview you did, and I'm finding a conflict between the two. How do you not hurt someone's feelings if you have a controversial idea? And if we agree that we're meant to be doing the least harm, does that mean we stop saying it? At what point does this moral code kick in? How much hurt feelings are we allowed to tolerate or cause someone?
Well, there's no answer to how much hurt feelings in general, because it depends on what's on the other side. So certainly we should not gratuitously hurt someone's feelings. And a lot of the nastiness that you find on social media, where people do abuse each other and sling off, is quite wrong, because it's not serving any real purpose. You know, maybe people are letting off steam for themselves, but it's not serving a purpose. On the other hand, when it comes to controversial ideas, if the ideas are ones that have the possibility of being right and of making a positive difference to the world, then I think we should be prepared to accept a certain amount of hurt feelings. I don't think we can say that you can't express an idea that might hurt someone's feelings, because it would be hard to say anything new or different.
Exactly.
If that were the case, right? So a lot of the things that we now take for granted, you know, like, let's say, the idea that people with a same-sex orientation ought to be able to marry, that would have been regarded as extremely offensive to many religious people who thought that this was a terrible perversion and contrary to God's will and so on. So, you know, we wouldn't, you could imagine those people, if they took the standards of today, saying, well, you know, we have to make sure that nobody is allowed to express those views. We have to cancel them, if you want to use that term, so that these dangerous and perverted views, contrary to God's will, don't get into the community. But obviously that would have been a bad thing to do. So we have to be prepared to accept that if ideas are serious ideas that have the potential to make a difference in the world and a positive difference, we have to allow, I think, ideas to be exchanged and to be argued about. And that's the way in which we find out what is right and what isn't.
The way I'm seeing it is, if we're not willing to explore bad ideas, we risk not ever getting to the good idea. Because I don't always say what I mean the first time as well as I want to say it when I'm building a program here or something like that, but it leads to an idea of significance down the track. But if it wasn't allowed to flourish in the beginning, when it was very misguided or completely off base, it never would have come to fruition and touched people's lives. So surely it's an imperative that this idea of freedom to explore different ideas that may conflict with somebody else's needs to be encouraged.
Yes, I agree entirely with that. And not only do we need to have, you know, criticism and discussion to refine our own ideas and improve them, but even if somebody, you know, even if an idea is correct, I think people don't really understand why it's being held unless you allow somebody to object to it. And then somebody else will respond to that objection and lay out the reasons why we hold this idea. Because if you don't have that, it's just like a dogma. It's just something, well, this is something we all believe. But why do we believe it? You know, do we allow it to be questioned and challenged? And has it withstood those challenges? If it has, then we have an answer to why we believe it. If it hasn't, maybe we don't have an answer.
How would you describe the state of the academy right now, given the amount of controversy around controversial ideas and professors being cancelled, or younger people in the academy feeling intimidated? How would you describe the state of play, and what is it you would like to see?
Yeah, it's not as terrible as it's sometimes been painted, but it's certainly also not as good as it could be. And I do count myself fortunate that I'm not starting out as a young academic without any security of position at this particular time, because who knows, I might not have got further. So
I'm thinking of one idea you may have had that came up in Germany that perhaps wouldn't have been that helpful if it was this time.
Right. So you're talking about my ideas about parents having the possibility of euthanasia for their severely disabled infants. Yes. That certainly evoked a lot of controversy and still occasionally does. I haven't seen arguments to suggest that I was wrong, but perhaps I have come to realize that people are not always as well informed about the prospects for their disabled children as they should be. And so now when I talk about this, I encourage parents to make contact with organizations for people with the disability that their child might have, and try to learn more about what kind of a life prospect their child may have. Or I have learned something from that controversy anyway, even if I haven't completely changed my views. But to get back to your question about the academy, I've been disappointed that some of the leaders of academic institutions have not stood up for freedom of speech as firmly as they should have, and have yielded to protests and petitions and so on when I think they shouldn't. I'm fortunate that when I was appointed to Princeton in 1999, there were some protests because of my views about euthanasia and abortion as well. And one of the members of the Board of Trustees, that is the governing body of Princeton, called for my appointment to be rescinded. But the president of the university stood up strongly for academic freedom mm-hmm. and was supported by every other trustee on the board. So I'm glad that happened. And I'm pretty confident that would happen again at Princeton with the president we have today. But obviously there are some other academic institutions around the world where people don't stand up in that way.
Mm. How would you like to see it? Other than the leaders standing up, what would be the invitation that you would put out that perhaps we need to start bringing back into academia or introduce for the first time there?
I think what we need to bring back is greater respect for freedom of thought and discussion, and somewhat less sensitivity to people being offended. I think that has been taken too far, and people have extreme stances on things that have caused offence. And that certainly wasn't the case when I was starting out as an academic. So, I'd like to see more robust discussions. I'd also like to see less political partisanship in a way. I have a feeling now that people sort of, let's say if they're progressive, if they're on the left side of the political spectrum, they feel they have to adopt the whole package of positions. I certainly consider myself on that side of the spectrum in many areas, but I don't feel that I have any obligation to support everything that's said. And there are some things that are said by people on that side that I will disagree with. And I think it's much better to respond issue by issue than to take up a whole group and say, this is what progressives believe, so this is what I believe.
Let's throw religion in there. I would say maybe that as religion goes down, secularism comes up, nothing's changed in the human being's desire to connect, to belong, and to know what they stand for. As religious dogma decreases, other dogmas seem to increase. Do you see any parallels? Is that anything you've given thought to?
I've certainly given thought to, in a way, I suppose, the resilience of religious belief, which, if you'd asked me 50 years ago whether it would be as strong today as it is, I would have said no. I think it's on the decline, and it's particularly in those nations where people have high levels of education, it will continue to decline. But that hasn't happened. Maybe it has declined somewhat over that period, and depending on which country you're talking about. But part of the reasons for that resilience is, I think, as you say, people have a need to belong. And the question is, for some people, their church or mosque or synagogue has been that place. And is there really something that can replace it? Now, I think that's, again, that does vary from country to country and the strength of your institutions that you might be part of and your group of friends. But I think it's part of the reason why a secular view hasn't become more or less universal among people with some education.
Mm. Morality seems to be difficult for humans. We seem to wrestle with it. What are your thoughts on how to bring a moral frame to decision-making? How do you approach morality? What are your thoughts on it? And perhaps throw into the mix sentimentality and your thoughts on that, because we do seem to squish them all up together.
Right, we do. So one of the things that I think about when I approach moral issues is I try to distinguish my gut responses, what you might call yuck reactions, from my reason judgments. Yes. So, I think we are clearly evolved beings. We have evolved from social mammals over millions of years. We have, our closest relatives are the other great apes, because we are also great apes. And we know a lot more now about the behavior of great apes and of other social mammals. And we also know a lot more about what goes on in our brains when we're asked about moral dilemmas. There have been scientists like Josh Green who've ask people moral dilemmas while they're having their brain scanned and see what bits of their brain are active at that particular time. So we know now that we have these kind of instantaneous responses to descriptions of certain situations, which are visceral, which we might say, yeah, no, that's wrong. But I think we also know enough to say these are biologically evolved. These helped our ancestors to survive and to reproduce and to ensure their children survived for millions of years. And so they have been, to some extent, hardwired into our psychology. But that doesn't mean that they're the best way of approaching questions in the 21st century, where things are very different. And, and this goes to one of the things that you said earlier about when we're in proximity to people, or to animals for that matter, we'll respond much more strongly than if we're merely thinking about distant strangers or animals far from us. And that's because for all of those millions of years, we lived in small face-to-face societies. Most people think that humans lived in groups of between 1 and 200. So we knew everyone in those societies. It was a lot of mutual helping, obviously. We helped them and they helped us in times of need. And we responded to them. But we didn't really know or care in the same way for people who might be living just on the other side of the mountain ridge of our valley. So when we now have much greater ability to assist people on the other side of the world, and when we're much more interwoven with them, as of course the pandemic shows, because you know we didn't get the pandemic from within Australia, it came from outside, then we have to change. We have to think on a larger, more global scale. And that kind of small group morality that is still wired into us in some respects really needs to change, or we need to change the decisions we make so that they do have a broader focus.
How does that reconcile with your views on border management, international border management?
Well, I think there are two things that I want to say on this. One is that, as I said earlier, my morality is quite impartial, and the interests and well-being of somebody who comes from the other side of the world shouldn't count less for that reason than the interests and well-being of my fellow Australians. But at the same time, I recognize that that is a rational take on the issue, which for most people is not going to be dominant. They're all capable of taking that view of it, and maybe they have some attraction to it, but they also have this more visceral response that strangers are not as good in some way as the people that I know and associate with. This kind of certain element of xenophobia, of fear or hatred of strangers that I think still resides within many people. And I regret the fact that it does, but we can't just ignore it, right? I think we can't just say, well, so let's open our borders. That would not lead to a good situation because of the hostility of many people in any countries. It's not particularly about Australia, in any countries to an influx of a large number of strangers, particularly people who don't look like them or don't have different religions or different customs. So in a democracy anyway, I think that I do not advocate that governments take a sort of open borders stance. That seems to me to be a mistake. And obviously the political parties that are more likely to do that would be the political parties that I have more sympathy with and whose policies I generally endorse. But they are not going to achieve office if they take that stance. And so therefore, not only a good policy on accepting asylum seekers and refugees would be lost, but good policies on climate change, good policies on greater assistance for disadvantaged people within our own country, better policies on foreign aid, all of those things would be lost. And that's why I understand that politics is a matter about what's possible, about a compromise between what your ideals are and what you may be able to achieve if you're successful in political elections. So that's why I don't really take this stance of saying that any political party that restricts intake of asylum seekers is doing something wrong.
So one of the things I want to talk with you about is you said on Andrew Denton, and I'm going to quote you to get it correct, that if you and your wife had a child with Down syndrome, you would adopt the baby out. I would love you to talk about your thinking on this from a utilitarian point of view and have our viewers understand your mind, because your rationality is so clear. And I'm really curious about how you come to that and, yeah, how you come to that.
Right. Okay. So I think that probably is what we should do. But to be fair, since it's only me talking and I don't want to really talk on behalf of my wife, she has her own views, which are not necessarily identical with mine. So let me just say that I'm speaking for myself.
Fair.
Maybe it's something about the kind of person I am, but I would like to have a child who I can have eventually, obviously, not immediately when they're very small, but who I can have the kind of conversation that you and I are having now with. And I think that's unlikely with a child with Down syndrome. To me, it would be a shadow hanging over the relationship. I know that children with Down syndrome, people with Down syndrome can be very loving and warm and close. But it would be a shadow over the relationship that I think I would always feel some regret about, that my child would not grow up to be the kind of child that I could regard as fully an equal in terms of thinking about issues about in the world and thinking how best to help the world and to make the world a better place. That's why I think I said that. Now, you know, some people have probably, the discussion arose from somebody asking me, given that I think that parents ought to have options of euthanasia for severely disabled newborns, whether I thought that was the right thing to do in the case of someone with Down syndrome. But what I am thinking about when I'm thinking about parents having that option is children whose lives are going to be ones of suffering for themselves. Where you're not likely to be able to find adoptive parents who would love and cherish that child. And I don't think Down syndrome is one of those cases. It's certainly not necessarily a situation of suffering for the person with Down syndrome. They can enjoy their lives. And because, as I say, they can be warm and loving children and people, there generally are couples who would be willing to adopt them. And that's particularly so now. It wasn't so before we had a test for Down syndrome in utero, because during pregnancy, because then, of course, we had a lot more Down syndrome children being born. And perhaps the number of children being born might, at some times and in some places, been greater than the number of parents willing to adopt a child with Down syndrome. But now that we do have those tests and there are far fewer children with Down syndrome being born, I think you could find loving adoptive parents, and that would be the best thing to do in those circumstances. As I say, if you had parents like me who would rather not bring up that child, but would have another child who might be able to meet the expectations that I just mentioned.
The reason I ask you that question is got nothing to do with my views on that, or really your views on it. It's just, I find it remarkable that you say these views when I see so many academics not saying in any way anything controversial. They are playing this really safe beige line. And every time I listen to an interview by you, and by now in my research, it's quite a few, you speak so plainly and clearly about your views without any hesitancy. How do you get to that? Or is that question just completely redundant to you? Because of course you should speak this way if this is the truth you've come to using your philosophical stance. I'm standing here going,
I probably wasn't born like that. I did adopt views which were out of the mainstream reasonably early on, as we've been talking about, including becoming a vegetarian when that was a very unusual stance to take. And then I also wrote something else I hope we'll get time to talk about the obligations of affluent people to give to people in extreme poverty and how best to do that. I defended those stances, and then I got into these discussions about euthanasia, which arose, I suppose, out of my questioning of the doctrine of the sanctity of all human life. Because the doctrine of the sanctity of all human life, if it doesn't embrace the sanctity of non-human life, obviously is a speciesist kind of doctrine. It draws this line on the boundaries of species. And I wanted to challenge that, and that got me to the views that we were just talking about. But I felt that, you know, well, if I'm a philosopher, I should be prepared to speak up and give reasons for these views that I hold and show why they're part of a coherent and defensible set of moral views, as I believe them to be.
Your mind is phenomenal. And I would love to speak with you now about effective altruism. Thank you for the segue, Peter. I was looking at the website givewell.org and the philosophy behind it. Please share with our viewers what you consider effective altruism to be, and then we can unpack it a little bit.
Right. So effective altruism is both a philosophical view on life and a social movement. The philosophical view on life is that one of your aims ought to be to make the world a better place. You know, obviously, you know, most of us are not saints. We're not going to devote ourselves 100% of the time to making the world a better place. But I think it's reasonable to ask people, certainly people who are not struggling to survive, to have that as one of their aims. And then the question is, so how do you do that? Or how do you do that most effectively? Because, you know, if you're trying to make the world a better place and you say, well, I've made the world a little bit better by donating to a certain charity, let's say, and then someone else points out, but look, let's say you donated $1,000 to that charity, that's good, but don't you realize that here's another charity that could have helped twice as many people or could have done 10 times as much good with that $1,000 as the one you gave to? And if that is the case, and that very often is the case, then it seems a mistake to donate to the charity that does less good. So effective altruism is about how to get the most out of your resources. And I gave the example of donating because that's an easy example, but your resource might not be money. It might be time that you can put into volunteering or helping or particular skills that you have that you can develop to help in one way or another. But whatever it is, I think we ought to be thinking about how can I use them as effectively as possible.
And would you like to speak about givewell.org? And I think there was another organization that you helped establish. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah, certainly. Yeah. Please. Well, givewell.org was the original organization that started assessing charities, not just on the basis of, you know, their paperwork or whether they were well run or how much they spend on administration, but on the basis of what impact were they having? How much good were they doing? And GiveWell pretty early on decided that, at least as far as charities helping humans are concerned, we can get the biggest bang for our buck by helping people in extreme poverty in low-income countries. You know, they've done very thorough research on that. My only criticism of GiveWell was that they were pretty narrow. In a sense, they were very nerdy because of the kind of research that they did. And they were not particularly user-friendly or appealing to a broad audience. So when after I wrote The Life You Can Save, which the first edition of which came out in 2009.
And you've just given away, I understand.
Sorry, I'd given away.
Is that the book you've just released electronically?
Absolutely, yeah. Well,
let's do a plug. So the name of the book is?
It's called The Life You Can Save. There's a brand new edition, well, 2019 edition anyway, very new. I am now giving it away either as an ebook or as an audiobook. And the audiobook is each chapter is read by a different celebrity who volunteered their time. So like the actress Kristen Bell or the singer-songwriter Paul Simon or the BBC personality Stephen Fry, they all read a chapter. Wow. You can go to thelifeyoucansave.org and you can download it for free. That organization, the fact that there is the lifeyoucansave.org, came out of the book because a guy called Charlie Bresler contacted me after reading the book. He was someone who had a very successful business career, but had never felt fully satisfied in his business career. And it always felt he wanted to be doing something that was more in accord with values of helping people. And he basically sort of, he was still working at that time, but he basically offered to retire from his business career and devote himself, I think he was in his 50s at the time, to establishing this organization. And that's what he did. I'm chair of the board, but he was the chief executive for many years. He just stepped down to a slightly less intensive role, and we now have an Australian called Rickard Wickström as the chief executive of the World Organization, and also working in Australia, of course. So, yeah, as I was saying, that organization is designed to be broader than GiveWell, to disseminate the results of GiveWell's research and of research by some other organizations that it followed GiveWell in doing that kind of impact-related research. And we will be increasingly doing some of our own research as well. But I think it's designed to have a broad appeal and to encourage people to think about their charitable donations and to go to the website. And you can look at about 20 recommended nonprofits that we have there. And you can donate to them through the website. And 100% of your donation will go to the organization. We're just providing the service without taking any commission or anything like that. So I hope people who are thinking of donating will have a look at that and find the organizations that you know they like and that suit their interests. They're all good ones, and they're all ones we unhesitatingly recommend.
And you've recommended them based on a rationale. You've literally studied how effective they are in getting the dollar to the person or the cause that needs the help rather than going on administration or any other costs.
Yes, that's right. It's the value you get, which might be saving the lives of children by preventing them dying from malaria, or it might be restoring sight in people who are blind and can't afford to get cataracts removed or can't afford to treat and prevent other forms of blindness, or providing surgery for young women who've given birth without medical assistance and have damaged their uterus and it's developed what's called a fistula, which means that there's a hole between the bowel or bladder and the uterus and they leak feces or urine through that. And their lives basically are ruined in those circumstances unless they can get some surgery. And the surgery is not expensive. It's a few hundred dollars. And you can give a young woman her life back. So, there are, you know, we've looked at all of those organizations and we're confident that they are using money that's donated to them with very high effectiveness.
My understanding this is in the public domain, Peter, but if you don't want to answer, that's fine. I did read in Ethics in the Real World, you believe we should talk publicly about our charitable donations. So I'd like to invite you, because I think I do know how much you give to make a difference. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm giving somewhere between a third and a half of my income. Look, I'm fairly fortunate. I'm still a professor at Princeton University. I'm half time now because I want to spend more time in Australia. But you know, professors are well paid there, and I have some other earnings. Obviously, you know, you've shown some of the books. I earn some royalties, and so I'm pretty comfortably off. So that's not a level that I'm recommending for everybody. That would, I recognize, be extremely tough for many people. What I do recommend is, and it's you can find it in the book, The Life You Can Save, if you want to download that copy from the website. I recommend a kind of progressive scale of giving. So people who are on fairly modest incomes, I suggest they start with 1% just to be giving something. And if they get comfortable with that and feel that that's okay and it's something worthwhile that they're doing, they build up from there. And on the other hand, you know, people who are very comfortably off, I think they can certainly get to the kind of level that I'm at. They can donate a third of what they're giving perhaps. And, you know, yes, they will have less cash, but basically the research shows that consumer spending isn't really very satisfying in the long run. You know, people get a bit of a boost when they get this exciting new car or whatever else it might be, but it wears off. Whereas the fulfillment from knowing that you're helping people and doing something good in the world doesn't wear off. It gives you a kind of a harmony between your values and your life that I think is very rewarding.
this question may be too pointed. It may be need to be an open question, but I sense, I don't think you do pride, but is it an equivalent for you in how you live your practical ethics so completely?
Look, I'm not really proud of what I do.
No, it's
because,
wrong word.
Because
wrong
I,
word.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, look, I could be doing better. As I said, I'm not a saint. I use the term fulfillment, I think, you know, what I feel. I feel that I've done a reasonable amount of good in the world. I feel I've used the talents and capacities that I had well and in a positive direction. And I'm satisfied with that.
You speak of being a hedonistic utilitarian, but I'm hearing meaning is more prevalent in your decision making.
Yes. So when people talk about hedonism, they tend to have this image of the pleasures you get as being sensual pleasures. You know, yes, being pleasures of food or drink or sex or lying on the beach in the sun or something like that. You know, and they're all good. I'm not putting these down at all. They are positive, but I think we are the kind of being that seeks something additional to that. Not yeah. instead of, but additional. And that is a kind of fulfillment or meaning in our lives. I think that's just the kind of beings that we are. And that is a kind of pleasure as well. You know, we shouldn't think of pleasures as only those physical ones. There are intellectual pleasures, and I'm not sure whether you'd call this kind of satisfaction an intellectual pleasure exactly, but it is a sense of meaning, pleasure in finding meaning in one's life.
Mm. One of the things I'd love to chat with you about as we come to the end is the Journal of Controversial Ideas, which I believe has launched. Is that correct?
It has.
Congratulations.
Yes.
Well done. That's awesome. So let's give credit to the three of you. It was yourself and two other academics that helped this come to fruition. Would you like to mention their names? I've got them here, but I'm going to mispronounce one of them.
Yes, okay. You're probably thinking of Francesca Minerva, who's an Italian academic who has herself been subject to abuse and physical threats for articles that she's published. And I have to say the original spark of the journal came from her. She talked to me about it, and we also talked to Jeff McMahon, who's a professor of moral philosophy at Oxford University and a good friend of mine. And it's the three of us who have put this together, essentially because we all believe that ideas are important. It goes back to what we were talking about the importance of being able to put forward different ideas. It is an academic journal, so it's not for everybody to just publish something in. But we send out all of the articles we receive to experts in the field, and we get their reviews of those articles. And if they think that they're well argued and rigorous, we'll accept them. Sometimes they say yes, but, and needs to be revised here or there. And then if the revision comes up, we accept them. And quite a lot of them we reject. But we have published the first issue. It's an online open access journal. We've had some donors who've made that possible. Yeah. So you can go to journalofcontroversialideas.org and you can read the first issue. You can also support the journal if you feel like doing that. The other particular feature, because of course there's lots of academic journals, is that we allow authors to publish under a pseudonym if they're worried about being subject to abuse or about damaging their career prospects, as we were talking about before. And of the We have 10 articles in the first issue, and three of those authors chose to publish under a pseudonym.
And the purpose of the Journal of Controversial Ideas is to provide a safe place, a voice for ideas that have been pushed out of the mainstream that perhaps you feel and think and have assessed need to be heard or are worthy of discussion. Have I captured the purpose of it?
Yes, that's right. Yes, we want to provide a sort of way in which ideas can be expressed, even if other forums are closed to them. And in fact, one of the articles, not one published under a pseudonym, but one of the other articles, the author put a little note there saying that this article had been accepted by a journal was positively reviewed anyway by the journal. It looked like it was about to be accepted. And then after the murder of George Floyd and the concerns, very proper concerns, of course, about racism, and the editors seemed to have second thoughts and then rejected it. So it's by no stretch of the imagination a racist article. It's discussing cultural traditions involving blackface, involving people colouring their faces, and whether those are always wrong or sometimes defensible. But, you know, that's an example of something that I think is a good, well-thought-of article, and as I say, in no sense a racist article, but something that journals didn't want to touch after in the last year or two.
How's the funding going? How's it going?
We've certainly got enough to publish the next couple of issues. So we're going to be around for a while, and I hope that as we publish more, we'll get more support from people who will like what we're doing.
We'll include links to everything we spoke about, Peter, and to all your major works as well in the show notes, so our viewers can access more of your thinking, which I think would be just marvelous. Is there anything we haven't spoken about as we wrap up that you feel is worth mentioning or you think maybe you'd want to address?
There is one more thing, actually, and I'll show it to you.
Please.
This is my newest publication. I can't say it's exactly my newest book because I didn't write it. I edited it. It's written by this person, Apuleius, who lived in the second century in the Roman Empire. And he wrote this really funny, bawdy novel about a man who by magic gets turned into a donkey. And what he experiences as a donkey. It's very funny, but it's also very empathetic to animals, quite surprisingly for something written in the Roman Empire. So I hope that your readers will pick it up and enjoy it.
That's going in the show notes as well, for sure, Peter. Absolutely. Sure. You're so good doing that. That's so fun. Look, thank you so much. Peter, on behalf of my team, who are all raving fans of you and people who aren't in the building, so there's 30 raving fans in this building who are excited that you're chatting with us. And as I said, this is going out to a lot of people who will be so pleased that your voice is amongst the many and much of the noise that's going on with such clarity and with such a beautiful clarion call to live a life of deep, practical morality. You're a good, kind man. I studied you at university last year. I read your book last year and I never dreamt I'd be, so I'm a bit of a fan.
Great. Well, terrific. And congratulations to you on building up that audience for
thank you
for what you're talking about.
Thanks, Peter. Keep up the great work. Please go with our blessings and our kind thoughts.
Thanks a lot, Sharon. Bye.
Thank you, Peter. Bye-bye. Bye.